terror strikes in Iran today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Gunmen storm parliament and a shrine in Tehran, killing at least 12 people.
For this to happen in the heart of the Iranian democracy, we need many answers to find out how this has happened. How can people get into the parliament and kill people like this without being noticed?
Plus, a group of Mormon women who say Trump's deportation policies are breaking up local immigrant families.
We ourselves were refugees. So that's an issue that, regardless of political persuasion, touches our hearts.
And a Jamaican sprinter remembers her first gold medal at a track and field meet.
That moment was just the bomb. The moment is just one that I'll never, ever, ever trade.
Those stories ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks for being here. Fireworks, that's all it was, according to Iran's supreme leader, and it will have no effect on Iran and its fight against terrorism, he says. Those are some very brazen words, considering what happened today in Tehran. Four gunmen shot their way into the Iranian parliament building. One attacker reportedly blew himself up during the standoff that followed. Around the same time, two shooters stormed a popular shrine in another part of Tehran, the mausoleum of Ayatollah Khomeini, Iran's late spiritual leader. When it was all over, at least 12 people were dead and dozens of people wounded. The so-called Islamic State claimed responsibility. Now, that would be a first for ISIS. We're going to hear several perspectives on this, starting with Rana Rahimpour, my colleague with the BBC Persian Service in London. Generally, people around the world see Iran as an extremely safe country. It's got strong intelligence and military forces. I mean, I even drove by the Ayatollah Khomeini shrine last year and thought, wow, all the sodium vapor lamps and, its minarets, and it must be one place that will always be safe. How could all this happen?
That is a big question, and that's what everybody is talking about. Obviously, these people were armed, and they shot everybody they could. But it's a huge question. The shrine itself, it's not that difficult to get into. So because it's for mourners or people who want to make donations. But the question is how they got into the parliament. And that's why, from ISIS's point of view, it is a success. Because to get into the heart of the Iranian democracy and kill civilians and people who were working for the parliament, that is huge.
What are Iranian officials saying at this point about who the attackers are? I mean, we're wheeling out ISIS and Islamic State. Do we know for sure that that's who was responsible for this?
They said that they are not sure about the identity of the attackers or the nationality of attackers. But so far they haven't rejected the idea that it was ISIS behind it. And the Revolutionary Guards released a statement in which they said there will be revenge.
I mean, Iran's Revolutionary Guards say this was an attack mounted by Saudi Arabia. Is there any evidence of that?
There is no evidence. And even in their statement, they haven't mentioned Saudi Arabia, but it's very difficult to come to any other conclusion because they said the attack comes a week after the US president have met with the leaders of a country in the region that sponsors the ideology of ISIS. And Iran, throughout all these years, has claimed that it was the Saudis who are ideologically and financially supporting ISIS. So it's difficult to think that they mean any countries other than Saudi Arabia. They also make a timeline and they say that, okay, first President Trump came here and sold more than $1 billion worth of weapons to the Saudis. Then they all cut off their relationship with Qatar. And 2 days later, this attack has come. They draw a conclusion that there has been a green light from President Trump and the Saudis are acting because they have his support in case of a more serious confrontation between Iran and Saudi Arabia.
How do you think Iran's government will react now? I mean, when I was in Tehran, I saw lots of posters of Iranian martyrs, men who'd gone off to fight ISIS in Syria and Iraq to keep the fight over there and not in Iran. What will happen now? Will the government step up the fight against ISIS?
Well, at the moment, you know, they're all very shocked and moved by what has happened. And the Revolutionary Guards in their statement said that there will be revenge. But are they going to up the game immediately, or are they going to assess the situation and see whether it's a wise move? I think that's early to say. So far, in my opinion, under President Rouhani's administration, most of Iran's foreign policy decisions have been very wise. He's quite different from President Ahmadinejad, the ex-president, who was very hostile towards the West. So I think that we're not going to see an immediate confrontation with Daesh and with Saudi Arabia.
Iran is a Shia country primarily, but there are pockets of Sunnis, and ISIS had been reaching out, we hear, to the Sunnis in Iran. Is suspicion falling on extremists who entered Iran from outside the country or people who were already inside Iran?
Well, it's very early to say, but so far the Sunnis have rejected ISIS's ideology and their invitation to join them. So in total, I don't think that the Sunnis, despite all their disagreements with the central government, despite all the criticism they've had as a minority in the country, I think it's unlikely for Sunnis in Iran to join them.
My colleague Rana Rahimpour there with the BBC's Persian service in London. By the way, ISIS's animosity toward Iran comes as no surprise to those who follow ISIS propaganda. Here's more on that from The World's Matthew Bell.
A little over a month ago, an ISIS propaganda outlet released a video. It appeared to show the execution of four Shia fighters. That's grim, but typical. What was notable about the video, though, it was in Farsi, not Arabic. Farsi is the national language in Iran. And the message from ISIS was a call to arms of sorts. It was a call for the minority Sunnis in Iran to rise up and fight the Shia government. Will McCants is with the Brookings Institution, and he's the author of The ISIS Apocalypse. McCants says the hostility between ISIS and Iran starts with religion.
Sunni jihadists in general have a dim view of the Shia. For ISIS, they are certainly apostates. Ignorance of religion is no excuse, they would argue. They are all beyond the pale and worse than infidels like Jews and Christians because the Shia, they argue, have made a choice to place themselves outside of true Islam, as they would see it.
It might not seem to make a whole lot of sense strategically. ISIS has its back against the wall. It's losing territory in both Iraq and Syria. That's made it harder to recruit new fighters. But McCants says there are reasons ISIS would want to strike Iran now.
One is to, of course, punish Iran for its meddling in Iraq. The second would be to force Iran to go all in Iraq, to commit even more forces and to turn this into a major sectarian war, the thinking being that if this is divided along sectarian lines, that ISIS will gain more support by the locals, who Sunnis, who don't want to be overrun by Iran.
McCants says ISIS would also like to goad Iran's Shia government into cracking down on the Sunni minority in Iran. That could lead to unrest, and ISIS is a group that thrives on chaos. An attack like the one in Tehran today is also an ISIS recruiting tool itself, says McCants.
So it wants to maintain the momentum to show that it's still in the fight. And what better way to do that in the jihadist world than to carry out a strike in the heart of Iran, at two of its major symbols of power.
For their part, the Iranians see ISIS as a regional menace, but there are different messages coming out of Tehran. The Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, compared today's attacks to firecrackers, and he said they won't have any impact whatsoever. Iran's Revolutionary Guard took a harder line. It pointed the finger at Saudi Arabia and the United States and promised revenge. Ali Vaez is an Iran expert with the International Crisis Group in Washington.
Because this is the first attack by the Islamic State inside Iran's borders, I think this will have serious consequences for Iran's both domestic and foreign policies.
Vaez says Iran has been lucky, as wars to the east and west have raged for years in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan. The Islamic Republic has remained an island of relative stability. He says it was only a matter of time until an attack like this took place inside of Iran.
This might be a wake-up call. I expect, as a result of this attack, to see not only a certain rally around the flag effect that I think is inevitable in circumstances like this, but also an extreme securitization of the domestic sphere, because for three decades in Iran, Nothing like this has happened in Tehran.
Baez adds that today's attack in Iran provides an opportunity for the Trump administration. The Trump White House could demonstrate to the Iranian public, especially, Baez says, that the U.S. unequivocally rejects terrorism and that it sees ISIS as a common enemy. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
President Trump has now put out a statement on the attacks in Tehran. He said he prays for the victims, but Trump also added that, quote, states that sponsor terrorism risk falling victim to the evil they promote, end quote. That's aimed pretty directly at Iran. The events in Iran today came as a shock for many people, including the many Iranians who live here in the U.S., like the world's own Shirin Jafari.
I woke up this morning and I did what many of us do in the morning. I checked my phone and what do I see? I see a list of alerts, breaking news alerts. I realized that there's been an attack in Tehran and that the Islamic State has taken responsibility for it. It took me a couple of seconds to take in what happened because this is just so rare.
Yeah, I mean, it's shocking. And why is it so rare in Tehran?
Something like this has never happened, at least in the past 2-3 decades, not in my lifetime. It's basically because Iran has been very good at keeping the country safe, keeping the borders closed. And for Islamic State to be able to penetrate, do something like this at the heart of the country, at, you know, two very symbolic locations, at the parliament and at the shrine of the late Ayatollah Khomeini, who was the supreme leader, this is just so surprising to me.
Well, we spoke earlier on the show about security, but I'm just wondering, do you know if there was anything that preceded this, that triggered this?
There was a video that the Islamic State published back in March, and I saw it. And in that video, what the fighters are trying to do, they're trying to get the attention of the Sunni population in Iran. Iran is a Shiite majority country, but there are pockets of Sunnis within the country. And in the video, they said, we're going to bring the fight to Iran. We're going to attack these Shiites, who, by the way, Islamic State considers not Muslims. And then when I saw that video, I didn't really make anything of it because, just like I said, Iran has always been really good at security. And I just thought this would never happen in Iran.
There are, of course, a lot of Iranians outside of Iran, and I've seen strong reaction from them today. What have you seen?
There's been an outpouring of support. Since the news broke, people have been sharing images of the Iranian flag, the map, and using hashtags, we stand together, pray for Tehran. Some people have been questioning why the Facebook security check-in wasn't activated. Mm. We know that Facebook is blocked in Iran, but a lot of people are able to get around that.
What have you been hearing from Iranians that you know, Shirin?
I spoke with a friend of mine. He lives in London, and we went to school together. And, you know, there's been an attack in London, and there's been one in Tehran just in a week. And he said, it's been an emotional time for me. He said, both cities are my home, and, you know, I'm very upset about this. And then he said, you know what? What I decided to do after the latest attack was to go and donate blood. This was a way for me to give a part of my body to somebody else, and that would hopefully save somebody's life. And he said, you know, by doing that, I'm making a statement. I'm showing my middle finger to the terrorist who carried out these two attacks, both in Tehran and in London.
Yeah, and London and Tehran have been your homes at various times as well, Shirin. This can't have been an easy week for you.
It's been hard. I mean, it's hard. Every single attack is hard. You know, whether it's Kabul, whether it's Paris, whether it's London, it's hard. People's lives have been lost. But, you know, this morning I just woke up in shock and I just wonder if we're going to be waking up to another attack every day.
The world's Shirin Jafari. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
What is it about fast Jamaican runners? That's next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. Jamaica is a nation of less than 3 million people, but it produces some of the highest numbers of Olympic medal winners in track and field in the world. A new documentary has been looking into why this is, how you actually produce the next Usain Bolt. And the answer lies in an incredibly intense system of competition among the nation's teenage athletes. For many young sprinters in Jamaica, running offers a unique escape from poverty. Isaac Solitaroff is the producer of the program called The Sprinter Factory. He's in our London studio. And Okelia Buchanan is one of the athletes featured in the documentary. She was ranked 8th in the world in the 2013 junior 400 meters, and she joins us on the line from Kingston, Jamaica. Isaac, first of all, what is the Sprinter Factory and why is it so effective?
Well, Jamaica has been obsessed with track and field since well before Usain Bolt and Shelly-Ann Fraser-Pryce. And now the collective hopes of the 3 million Jamaicans are placed on the shoulders of these high school athletes. You have this Champs high school track and field meet that has been going on for 117 years, where kids from all over the island compete against one another. You have 35,000 Jamaicans with their vuvuzelas. I never quite know how to pronounce that.
Yeah, that kind of horn that we were introduced to at the World Cup in South Africa.
That's right. I can still hear it echoing in my head 6 weeks after having been there, but I can never quite pronounce the name. Anyway, so the entire island is fixated on this high school track and field tournament.
It sounds like quite a scene, almost like an NBA draft, but with more at stake. What is it like to attend this?
It's like
Champs?
The World Series. It's like the World Series and the World Cup rolled into one.
Well, it's a great point to bring in one of the young runners you profile in the documentary, Okelia Buchanan, who actually you're trying to recover from injuries in time for the next Champs. What drove you to run, Okelia?
I think I've been doing athletics since I was like 5 years old, since kindergarten, basic school. So I think it's that passion. From then on, it drove me to understand that, hear what, you were built for this. So knowing that my family or my background is not from a wealthy perspective, it's a way out for many people. And I would think about it as a way of me trying to make a better for myself and my families.
So aside from passion for the sport, you also thought it was a way to get you out of poverty and your family. What's really striking about Isaac's film is how whole families are depending on people like you, Okelia, you know, succeeding as athletes, succeeding on the track. How does that pressure affect family life?
The pressure, it really, for me, I really think that it does not affect my family life, because I'm getting a lot of support from my family members, friends. So it's just for me to manage everything well, train hard as usual, and the results will come.
If I could just say, Marco, the pressure, what Champs does is it really tests their physical talents. But there's also this huge psychological testing of their psychological mettle. Because there's so much pressure and there's so much, you know, it's so loud in there and there's so much riding on this. And there was a coach who said to me, Champs is the reason why Jamaica is so dominant in track and field, because if they're able to compete at this young age with this degree of pressure and competition, when they get to the international stage, they're ready for it.
That's really true, because based on what I've experienced, I would never trade Champs moment, my gold medal moment, for anything else, because that moment was just the bomb. It was just like everything, that crowd, you know, you're walking up to the line and all of your friends in the stands, they calling to you and you're not hearing them. And when they see you, they're like, my girl, they don't hear me calling you. And I'm like, girl, I was focusing, I can't hear you right now. And people from different schools, you know, cheering you on. You don't really know them, but, you know, when you see them that next time, you know, you have to say thanks for the motivation or thanks for the cheer and I loved it and everything. But the moment is just one that I'll never, ever, ever trade. It's just those are the things that keep me going just the same or inspires me to continue athletics.
Okelia, you sound like a champion. I just want to say that. But we've also heard in the documentary one of the coaches telling Isaac that if an injury occurs, it's just a matter of moving on to the next runner. Does that make you feel like you're being used, like you could be replaced by somebody else just as fast?
Yes, it does. It's just a part of reality where me being injured the coach tries to look at someone else who can fit my space. And that was a bit, it drove me crazy, really, because you always want to be at the top. You always want to be that number one priority for your coach. But as I said, the spirit of your friends, your families, keep you going strong. Like, you just don't want to give up because you just want to make everybody proud at the end of the day.
So if the runners are feeling the pressure, the families are feeling the pressure, what about the coaches? How much pressure are
they
feeling?
The coaches are under so much pressure, Marco. I mean, they have these very coveted jobs. They have job security. They get paid a decent salary. Those are things that are hard to come by in Jamaica. And they're getting to do what they love, which is to coach young people in track and field.
Are performance-enhancing drugs part of the equation?
I really have pressed on this. And everyone, of course, vehemently denies it. And people who will tell you openly and candidly that they suspect that there is performance-enhancing drugs among the senior athletes say that you would never find it among the juniors. There just isn't the money for it.
Isaac, is there anything U.S. schools could learn from what Jamaica's doing?
Well, I mean, honestly, Marco, I don't think this is all that different from what we see in the United States. I mean, you go to an inner-city basketball game or a football game in a rural part of Texas, you see the same bare knuckles competition. It's just that track and field is so essential to the sense of national identity in Jamaica that it takes it to a whole other level.
I need to ask you both, after hearing a report a few years ago about the connection between diet and fast running in Jamaica, what is the connection between eating yams and running fast?
Do you know anything about this, Okayla?
Yeah, well, it's just a thing for us where we say that the country food, that the yams, the bananas, those are what give us that strength and that force, that powerful force. People believe that, you know, that's what keeps us going strong running.
I'll take any theory at this point. You guys are just so fast. Well, Isaac Solitaroff and Okayla Buchanan, thanks very much for being with us. Great to speak with you.
Thank you so
much. Thank you.
Okayla Buchanan is one of the young runners featured in The Sprinter Factory. The documentary was directed by Isaac Solitaroff and produced for The Guardian. Before we go to the break, here's a preview of a story we're working on for tomorrow's show. It's about protecting America's shores. Members of the U.S. Coast Guard have 95,000 miles of coastline to protect, and they have to prepare for every scenario.
We have mounted automatic weapons on our vessels. That deters a lot of threats, I believe.
Just a couple of miles from our newsroom, Boston Harbor has cruise ships loaded with passengers, huge tankers filled with liquefied natural gas, fishing vessels of every size, and all of them are vulnerable.
So we prepare for all these different scenarios to combat terrorism, a cruise ship grounding, or a mass rescue operation somewhere in Boston Harbor or beyond.
Our ride along with the Coast Guard on the show tomorrow. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Latin rock star Juanes has penned his fair share of protest songs, but for his new album,
I just wanted to have something positive because the world is so confusing now, it's so depressing, everybody's so angry. So I just wanted to talk about changing every day the way you live.
More from Juanes, that's just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Seems like almost every day we're hearing new allegations about how Russia tried to influence last year's U.S. presidential election. Here in the U.S., each new revelation makes big headlines. But here's how that same story sounds on RT, the Kremlin-backed Russian news outlet.
Well, many of the claims regarding alleged Russian meddling in the U.S. elections have been spread through questionable online sites. It turns out that even experienced politicians can fall victim to fake news online, which they then spread further through interviews on major networks.
That's news anchor Rory Suchet on RT International. The politician in question, Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey, who apologized after erroneously claiming a New York grand jury was investigating President Trump's campaign ties to the Russians. It's a story that got some play, though not much, in U.S. media outlets. That's just one example. Tomorrow, RT will be, like all news outlets, covering former FBI Director James Comey's testimony in Congress. But RT's deputy head of news, Alexei Kuznetsov, says there's been so much hype in advance of the hearing, he's downplaying coverage today.
the level of hysteria about this specific hearing has been so high on the mainstream media that, you know, we thought that our job had already been done by our colleagues from other news stations.
You talked about hysteria, but I mean, isn't this a very important meeting and does deserve some urgency and a little bit of hand-wringing, I think?
It obviously does deserve some attention, but not if you talked about this for like 2 or 3 weeks in a row without, you know, without any stoppage. There are other stories around. There's Iran, there's Syria, there's the Philippines for that matter. But, you know, specifically this Russian enigma, you know, attract the Western media so much they can't switch to anything else.
Back to the U.S. election. Do you see any proof that Russia meddled in it?
I don't think that either at RT or anywhere else has anyone ever heard any convincing proof or any convincing evidence that the Russians hacked anything. Well, maybe Comey will tell us something. I don't know.
Yeah, or maybe we'll find out a little more about that document that the NSA contractor Reality Winner leaked out, we heard yesterday. Does RT take sides?
Well, of course we don't. If you call rendering the Russian government viewpoint on issues of international importance taking sides, then we probably do. But editorially, I mean, we try to report from all possible angles and from all possible sides. You know, we try to give the floor to different parties, but sometimes these parties don't really want to talk to us. Like, for instance, Hillary Clinton's election headquarters never actually let us in during the election campaign. Neither did President Macron when he was running for presidency. So it's sort of hard to give the floor to the people who don't want to take that floor and talk to you.
I mean, when you come down to it, it does feel often like RT is the same thing as Breitbart.
Oh, Jesus. That's a funny comparison to make. What makes you think so?
Well, I mean, kind of the tone that you're the alternate voice for Americans who really need to hear the truth.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't want to comment on Breitbart, but I don't know what their editorial policy is. But, you know, in our approach to news, we do indeed try to focus on those people and those events that have either been underreported or not reported properly, as far as we understand. We try to give the floor to the people who feel sort of sidelined or left out and, you know, can't really deliver their message on mainstream media. I don't know if Breitbart does the same thing. I don't know. Maybe there is some similarity.
We'll leave it there. Let me just ask you this. The Moscow Times recently reported that some RT journalists described a non-disparagement agreement that they had to sign when agreeing to work for RT. Did you sign that sort of agreement?
Is standard practice in all Western companies, and the Moscow Times actually tried to make a mountain out of a molehill. You know, you can't surprise anyone in the West or in a Western company with a non-disclosure agreement. Let me tell you that. And speaking about myself, yes, I did sign that agreement.
Why is that kind of agreement needed? It sounds like RT may have things going on there that they're not proud of.
No, not really. It's just standard practice that exists all over the world.
Well, I didn't sign one in my current job, and I don't think I've never signed one.
Well, maybe that will become an issue with your bosses and yourself at some point. I don't know.
Maybe I shouldn't have started talking about it. We'll see. What sort of influence do you think RT has today? Like, how do you see its place in the broader media landscape?
We probably would have been operating on a much smaller scale if it hadn't been for this free advertising that we're being given day and night by our Western colleagues. You know, so I guess our influence is growing with the gracious help of our colleagues abroad.
Alexei Kuznetsov, Deputy Head of News for Russia Today, speaking with us from Moscow. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Marco.
Anne Cooper has a very different take on RT's operations. Anne is a professor at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism, and she's monitored the Kremlin-backed RT for more than a decade.
A lot of the reporting, and even that reporting about the U.S., will be not wildly different from what you might see on CNN or Fox. The two big differences, one comes with op-eds that are on their website and some of the commentators they bring on who have very dubious credentials. The other area where you'll see RT really become RT is when it's an issue of, you know, foreign policy sensitivity. Georgia, back several years ago when Russia was fighting there. Ukraine, certainly. Syria, Russia backs the Assad regime. And so what is said on RT about Syria and what Assad is doing and what other forces are doing, that's much more carefully vetted, let's say.
Mm. How would you compare RT to Breitbart? I mean, is it fair to talk about both in the same breath?
Some people would say Breitbart and RT have a similar aim, which is to go after mainstream Western media, to present a range of alternative views, alternative versions of what might be the explanation for something like, for example, the downing of the Malaysian airliner over eastern Ukraine. All kinds of conspiracy theories were put out on RT, some of them pretty wild, without any real proof. But the idea appeared to be, let's confuse things. Let's divert attention from the criticism of us, Russia, and spread it around and create some other possibilities so that people are really left wondering, well, where is the truth? And I think people who've studied Breitbart far more than I have noted that that's, if not a stated goal, certainly an effect of Breitbart News.
How influential is RT today? Like, who watches it and follows it online?
You'd have a lot of trouble finding the answers to that. The statistic that RT likes to put out is what their reach is, meaning how many TV sets around the world could actually tune in RT, and it's tens of millions. That doesn't mean that those people have it tuned in. It just means that it's there. Mm. They do have their YouTube channel gets a lot of hits, 2 billion, maybe even more than that now. But one study a couple of years ago noted that, you know, most of the people who are going to YouTube, to RT's YouTube channel, are looking at its kind of basic news clips, natural disaster, you know, terrorism attack, the kinds of things that, you know, you could go to CNN or you could go to RT. Not sure why they're going to RT for that.
There was today on RT Online an op-ed piece titled, In Europe, Trump is Making Russia Great Again. And the person who wrote that, the byline tells us, is Brian McDonald, an Irish journalist who is based in Russia. I know RT originally hired some well-known U.S. journalists. Why do journalists go there to work? What motivates them?
One reason that some people who've worked at RT have told me is the money. They do have a lot of money to spend. I know a young person who worked there for a year or two. He was in Moscow doing something else, and this is kind of typical. They find Americans or Brits or other Westerners who are there working in some capacity and hire them and, you know, teach them how to put together a news package. It's good pay.
So tomorrow, James Comey will testify on Capitol Hill. I'm just curious how RT handled the hacking of the U.S. election story. And is there any case that they meddled in the 2016 vote?
RT has been denounced by most recently by Emmanuel Macron, but, you know, a couple of years ago by John Kerry and other U.S. officials as a propaganda bullhorn. In terms of the whole Russia scandal, I think RT's coverage has tended to be, well, it's relied a lot on the statements of Vladimir Putin and Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister. And they say, this is nonsense. Where are you getting this stuff? You know, don't you have better things to do? Of course we didn't do that, blah, blah, blah. And I would imagine that might be the kind of thing that we'll see tomorrow when they're writing about Comey.
Ann Cooper has monitored RT for more than a decade. She's now a professor at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. Thanks a lot, Ann. Really appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you very much.
It started as a private Facebook group with a few Mormon women in Utah. They were upset about the Trump administration's travel ban. But within a few weeks, their private group went national. Now they're focused on trying to stop deportations. Andrea Smarden has that story from Utah.
I'm with a group of demonstrators in front of the Office of Homeland Security in West Valley City, Utah. On the bullhorn is Charlie Mullins Glenn, founder of the new group Mormon Women for Ethical Government.
Thank you for coming today to show solidarity for Sylvia and her beautiful family standing here.
This is where 31-year-old Sylvia Avalar Flores was detained before she was taken to jail in April. Avalar Flores was brought to the U.S. from Mexico when she was a child. She grew up here, got married, and had three children, all U.S. citizens. Mullins Glenn says Avalar Flores may have stayed here illegally, but she's not a criminal. ICE officers apprehended her in the parking lot of a craft store with her 8-year-old daughter. They'd been tracking her for a few days after she failed to appear at an immigration appointment. Avalar Flores has said she did not know about the meeting.
That this woman would be detained in front of her child, put in jail, and slated for deportation is unconscionable and flies in the face of the very values we hold most dear in this community.
Everything about this offends my religious beliefs.
MJ Munger is one of the demonstrators here.
I am standing in solidarity with Sylvia to try to protect a family to stay together. For me, that's a core value beyond anything else, is the families need to be together.
Munger says until now, her political activism only went as far as volunteering at a food pantry.
It's probably obvious I'm an introvert. I'm a shy person. My belief is what fills me up with a fire to go past the shyness and to stand out.
A majority of American Mormons identify as politically conservative, but Angela Wentz-Falconer says she's been rethinking her political allegiance.
Yeah, I've kind of been switching. I was more Republican, and then I've definitely moved towards the Democratic side because I just feel like we need to be for common sense. What has been happening, this isn't common sense.
Later, sitting in her car, Charlie Mullins-Glenn tells me how her group got started. She was talking with some like-minded friends after the election. Then they moved the conversation online.
It quickly snowballed. And within a few days, we had nearly 300 members. Within a week, we had close to 3,000 members. And by 2 weeks, we had 4,000 members. We're now approaching 5,000.
They now have members in most states and around the world. The group is not officially associated with the LDS Church, but Mullins-Glenn says immigrants and refugees have become a driving priority for Mormons like her.
We ourselves were refugees. So that's an issue that I think, regardless of political persuasion, touches our hearts.
That evening, Mullins-Glenn checks in on the family of a Mormon woman, Teresa Ramos, who was recently deported to Colombia.
This was where Teresa lived,
yes.
Right? So is Jeffrey, he's here now then? Oh,
yes.
Good. Wonderful.
Hi.
Ramos' son, Jeffrey Smithers, is 18. He has cerebral palsy and epilepsy. He says he has seizures about 2 or 3 times a month, which can put him in the hospital.
After I have those seizures, I tend to forget everything for the past whole day, and I don't recover until like a day or two after that.
Smithers is legally an adult, but still needs help. His cousin, Callie Dumas, says Smithers had a seizure the day after his mother was deported, and the family isn't sure how to care for him or what to do about health insurance.
We're trying to do everything that she did because she's unable to do it now, and it's a lot of pressure on our family.
When Mullins-Glenn leaves, she promises the family she will keep working to get Ramos returned to Utah.
We're not going to forget today, so we're going to keep fighting.
Yeah.
The next day, Mullins-Glenn gets news about Sylvia Avalar Flores, the woman who was apprehended at the craft store parking lot. She's been released from jail and will have a 90-day stay of removal. Mullins-Glenn and her group are hoping they can make that stay permanent. For The World, Andrea Smartin, Salt Lake City.
Andrea is creator of the podcast Changing Our Stories about the changing lives of Utah women since last year's presidential election. If food brings people together around a table, food trucks do the same thing but on the street and sidewalk. That's what's behind a campaign in Southern California called Taco Trucks at Every Mosque. The idea is to bring together Muslims and Latinos through food, and it's been catching on real fast in the parking lot outside the Islamic Center, Santa Ana, California. Activist Raida Hamida joins us now from, where are you, Raida?
I'm in Anaheim, California.
Beautiful Anaheim. Now, you've tried this a few times already. How did it go, the taco trucks at every mosque?
It was so exciting to see people that have fasted during the month of Ramadan to kofta and falafel and rice and hummus and maklouba. But for one night, they come and break their fast, many of them for the first time in their lives, to tacos. So it was a cultural exchange between the Latino and Muslim community. We are testing the waters with this new idea to introduce tacos to break their fast. And it was a huge success.
Was it a discovery for a lot of people? Were there some people who had never tried tacos?
It was interesting, even for my father that has been fasting, and he's 70 years old. He's been fasting since he's been, 14 years old, and it's his first time breaking fast.
So how did he like
taco.
It?
Well, he had like 10 tacos.
10? What kind of tacos was he most into? What did he like?
Majority, he asked for meat. It was carne asada. And he had like 2 chicken, which was interesting because the meat went really quick. We had ordered almost 200 pounds of halal chicken and meat from Fresh Choice Marketplace.
Am I right that part of your inspiration for this campaign is kind of picking up on what was said on the campaign trail last year, that warning from one Latino activist, a Trump supporter, who said to white America that Latino culture is so strong, you got to watch out or there will be taco trucks on every corner. Are you kind of riffing on that?
Definitely. I mean, Ben Vasquez and I were talking about
Ben, your co-partner in this.
My co-partner in this movement of taco trucks at every mosque. We're talking about how we can basically combat this fear. You know, this movement is about building community during an administration that really has tried to break our spirit with the Muslim ban and the building of the wall and separating our families and instilling fear. You know, this project's really important because it's breaking down those narratives. And so we want to really embrace these communities that are experiencing injustice and really love them and empower them. This experience with the Latinos really taking that challenge and fasting with us and experiencing that, it was so beautiful because, you know, we're learning from one another. It's not a one-way conversation. If it's Trump's worst nightmare that we're going to bring a taco truck to every mosque, then he really needs to start changing his dreams of what this future of America looks like, because we are the future of America.
Activist Raida Hamida helping to bring tacos to every mosque. Don't forget the jalapenos. Thank you very much, Raida.
Thank you so much.
Tacos or not, the news these days, as we all know, can be pretty dark. Thank goodness the world's William Troop has arrived just in the nick of time with some relief.
I happen to like the music of Colombian singer Juanes, have for a while, but his new album, Mis Planes Son Amarte, stands out for several reasons. First, it's really good. Juanes made the album with help from some young hip-hop producers from his hometown, Medellin. And that collaboration somehow helps many of the songs sound both rooted in Colombian tradition and edgy at the same time, like this track called El Ratico.
This song has a lot of influence from music from my hometown, like como música ranchera, you know, like but the beat is like a dance hall. So it's like a combination of those worlds put it together in the song.
The album also comes with a highly produced film, which you can see as a series of videos on YouTube. It tells the story of a lonely astronaut traveling through time and space looking for the love of his life. It's kind of trippy. Then there's Goodbye for Now, Juanes' first ever original song in English. And let's just say it's about time, given that Juanes has been living in the U.S. now for 20 years. Let's say goodbye for now. Doesn't mean I don't love you. But Juanes says there's something else that sets this album apart.
During all my career, I always have been writing music, social songs, sometimes more sad, sometimes more like protesta kind of thing. But in this case, I just wanted to have something positive because the world is so confusing now. It's so depressing. Everybody's so angry. It's so dense. So I just wanted to write a song about, you know, attitude, you know, just to have good attitude and just to talk about changing every day the way you live.
Las noticias dicen que todo está malo, pero yo prefiero ser más optimista. En mis manos solo cargo una guitarra y una buena actitud.
On that track, Actitud, Juanes starts out singing, "The news says everything's bad, but I prefer to be more optimistic." And the thing is, he really means that.
You know, when you turn on the TV, I mean, you watch all the news, I mean, it's so complicated, you know, Corea del Norte, Venezuela, you know, United States, Syria, Libya, it's so sad, you know, Manchester, it's like everything is happening at the same time, and it's hard, you know, just sometimes to be optimistic. So yeah, I mean, the world is very confusing, but I just want to try to make my own world better. That's the reason why I trust in art as a very powerful weapon of peace. I really believe that music makes you feel better.
And really, how could you not feel better listening to Juanes' three kids, Dante, Luna, and Paloma, on that chorus? What this world needs, they sing, is love and a better attitude. For The World, I'm William Troop.
And I'm Marco Werman. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. We'll be back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.